lot of the job placement stuff, honestly, tends to happen within individual networks connected with their internship sites. So once students are in that field placement, they're getting to know clinicians and agencies through state organizations and affiliations.
Hey everyone, this is Nathan, president of Saybrook University and host of the Saybrook Insights podcast. Really good to be here with all of you today. I'm joined by Jennifer Preston, Dr. Jennifer Preston, department chair for our counseling program. We have master's and PhDs in counselor education and supervision for our PhD and counseling for our master's program. Jennifer and I had just a fabulous conversation today, you know, really far-ranging, talking about mental health, the mental health crisis in our country, the various ways in which folks can identify and find great therapists and what therapy looks like and is and what to expect, all the way to applying for the counseling program, what to expect and how to navigate, the program if you're admitted into the counseling program here, and then what to expect after you graduate. So a lot of great stuff in that interview today. So really, really just pleased to have had that conversation with Jennifer. You know, as I was preparing for this podcast, the one thing that really stood out for me just personally was my father's mental health career. He worked as a rehabilitative administrator way back when I was a little boy, and then gravitated and moved into the mental health field and was in that area for the rest of his career, most of his career. And the sheer dedication that Dad had to those communities that he worked in, and we were in rural parts of Northwest Ohio where the need is high, the demand is high, but the resources and the staffing were low. It was a powerful career that Dad had, and one that was just seemingly unending in terms of what needed to be done. And I think what really stood out for me with my dad was that intense, deep dedication and love for his clients, the individuals that he served on a day-to-day basis, that sense that it wasn't about him, it was about how do I help these individuals really get to a better place into their own mental health and also into work that is satisfying, to live healthier, happier lives. And it just reminded me, my interview with Jennifer, as I was preparing, just how so many counselors, therapists, social workers, psychologists have that same unswerving dedication, and how difficult it can be, but also how rewarding and how important it is. I mean, think about it right now. The work being done and that's needed in our community, we have a pandemic that we're still in, massive global crises of multiple angles, from multiple angles, an economic crisis, rising inflation, strong financial struggles that are going on, not just in the United States, but around the globe. We've been seeing the impact of the Ukrainian war, both in the Ukraine and Russia, but also the impact of that, that unsettled conflict really ricocheting across the world, and how impactful that is for folks, including those directly impacted. And then there are kids. Our kids today are dealing with so much, ranging from social media to trying to navigate this crazy pandemic and all that it brings with it, along with the social relationships. I was just reading the other day as well for college-age students who are in undergrad, the level of isolation and detachment that so many professors are seeing across the United States, and the real concern that's out there around the connections that people are losing to not only their communities, but even their closer interwoven circles that they've had for years. This is a big, big problem. We have the opioid crisis. We have massive homelessness that's happening not just in our big cities, but also in our smaller areas of the country that is so dramatically terrible for those individuals experiencing it, as well as the professionals that are trying to address it, the politicians that are trying to address it. It's just a Gordian knot of epic proportions. And this really points to the need for more, not less, healthcare professionals, for more mental healthcare practitioners who can help ease the demand and support all of these individuals who need help. And I think if we're not attentive to that, whether it's Saybrook University or any of our other amazing institutions out there that are providing these professional training programs, we're not doing enough. And I would urge us all to think about, and I'll put out there a call to as many institutions as possible. We can't graduate enough of these individuals to go out there. And for those of you considering a career in mental health, now more than ever, we need you. We are at a crisis point of epic proportions, and we need your help. And, you know, is the pay great? It isn't always great, but we're seeing salaries increase. We're seeing, opportunities increase from wherever you might be now to other areas that you might want to relocate to. So, you know, the professions, in especially in mental health, are changing in a positive direction. So where there's demand and lower supply, we're going to see increases there as well. We need you. And, you know, my dad's now retired, so he's out of the game. And we need probably another 140 million more of you out there doing this work. I might be engaging in some hyperbole there, but certainly we need more of you, and we need more institutions to take this to heart. So my hope is that after you hear today's episode, that many of you will not only understand counseling as a profession and the need that's out there, but also just how powerful this program really is, and the work that we do in humanistic counseling. It's really relational. It's really engaged. It abides by all the major regulatory bodies, especially our KCREP accreditation requirements that are necessary for licensure across the country, or at least to sit for licensure. And so I think, you know, those are all important pieces to putting together a career in counseling. And it can be done if you're coming to this profession as a second or third career professional. Don't let that deter you. So many people out there I know question whether they can do school full time along with all their obligations. It can be done, and we have a very caring, compassionate, and dedicated faculty that are there for you. So I hope that you'll enjoy this episode as much as I did in terms of interviewing Jennifer Preston, Dr. Jennifer Preston, the chair of our counseling programs here at Saybrook University. And here she is. Dr. Preston, thank you for joining us today. Really glad
Absolutely.
To have you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. My pleasure. So before we get started, I thought maybe you could kick us off with telling us about yourself, your personal history as relates to the counseling profession. So wherever you'd like to start.
I was a psychology major in college, and had sort of big dreams of being able to do a lot of things with a bachelor's degree in psychology, and then pretty quickly figured out that that didn't work. those positions are not available. So I started working in a rehab facility for adolescents. It was a kind of a transition coming out of a inpatient program, and so I was doing case management for an outpatient portion of the agency's work. I knew that I wanted to do work that was nonprofit, agency-based, really kind of high crisis sort of work that always appealed to me. And so I started there, and then realized pretty quickly that I needed to get and wanted to get a master's degree in counseling and mental health counseling so I could be a licensed practitioner. So I pursued that degree and then went on to practice in some of those real high-risk areas. I did a lot of work in shelters, working with adolescents who were really experiencing a lot of homelessness, a lot of violence in their homes. Worked for a couple years in domestic violence and interpersonal violence work, and spent about 8 years doing clinical work, and had a child and took a little bit of a break. And then I found I had a position teaching a psychology course at a community college, and really fell in love with the teaching part. And how I found myself really transitioning from doing on-ground clinical mental health practice into the teaching within the field was really just my sense of how I could help and ways in which I could advocate for community and for populations, for me at just a little bit of a kind of a larger, broader scale in education than the one-on-one as a clinician.
What a rich background. I don't think I knew that about you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that's how you got into the academic side of counseling, which is really interesting. And I think kind of coming from that practitioner point of view, how'd you find your way to Saybrook University? Like, what made it stand out for you? Mm-hmm. And don't tell me it was my amazing leadership.
Well, in some ways it was, but you know, I taught for 9 years at a pretty traditional land-based state school. I really enjoyed that. That was my first faculty position coming out of my PhD program. But what I was finding there was I was not mission aligned, and the ways in which I really felt drawn to teaching and to clinical practice as I developed my own skills and my own identity as an educator just didn't match any longer with the sort of structure and mission of the university. And so I really wanted something that would let me kind of step into who I really knew I could be as an educator. I teach and practice from a feminist lens, from a trauma-informed space. And so I found Saybrook, and there was just a job posting. I had never heard of Saybrook, and went to the website and thought, oh my gosh, this feels so much like the work that I did and how I wanted to be in community and what I had always hoped an education space could be. And it felt a little too good to be true. I felt a little bit like I sort of found my people. I hear that from our students a lot. People, I don't know if I found Saybrook or Saybrook found me, but that's where I landed. I've been here for 7 years and in the department chair position for 6.5 of those. And it has just felt like just such a nice home and a really natural fit. I can sort of show up in this space as I am. And it's just been lovely.
Maybe dig into that a little bit. When you say you can show up as you are, I love how you put that. Like, maybe kind of build on that a minute.
I tend to be an emotional person. I tend to be pretty authentic as much as people can be in kind of a workspace or professional environment. I'm pretty aligned with who I am with my family, with my friends, with my work. I think that's unique. I think that for me, that's really at the heart of kind of humanistic work or humanistic clinical work, is letting people just be who they are and then working from that space and really honoring that and holding that in that relationship together. And as an educator, I think that's rare. I think there are ways in which typical faculty or education environments kind of there's a bit of a performative piece to it in what I have found in some of the other kind of more typical or more traditional learning environments, that just is it. This is just a space where people can really come into, and we work from there, person first, then the other pieces get layered on.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I would agree. I was just on a podcast interview. I was on the other end. So I was in your shoes just a few hours ago. And we were talking about that very thing, right? That it's such a different environment. I think higher ed, I mean, again, we all love higher ed. There's so many valuable things for all of our institutions across the United States. But I think where Saybrook kind of stands out and shines is that ability to allow us to show up as who we are and really valuing the individual's, you know, perspectives, what they bring to the table, as well as who they are just in general. You know, like that's an important aspect to it.
And I think when we can allow ourselves and then our students to do that, we're also really helping them develop the skills to let their clients come in and do that as well. So there's really that parallel process in being able to ask hard questions, to not understand things, to be having a difficult time and saying, I need some help. And so when we can do that as faculty and we can let our students do that, ultimately we're helping the community be able to come into these conversations with our graduates.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, one of the things you had mentioned around, you know, kind of the in-depth personal relational component is so important with the faculty and the students. I guess, and we'll get into a bit of this later on too, or in just a few minutes. How do you do that virtually? Mm. And we'll get into the departmental stuff in a minute, but I'm curious kind of globally from your perspective, how do you and the faculty manage that humanistic relational type of engagement on a virtual platform?
Yep. I will be honest, I was a little skeptical when I started. It really was a question for me about how can you do this work in this, you know, in a virtual platform. I think part of it is really prioritizing taking the time to build the relationship. So even in, for example, in our department meetings, we always start with check-in. We kind of share how people's families are doing, you know, what people are doing outside of work. And so we really, it's important to us to start with that and just getting to know each other. We've been growing our faculty department. And so really wanting to take more time to just see how people are doing. And by prioritizing that, I think then it lets us work really relationally and engage with students that way. Our residencies help, but certainly since the pandemic, we've been doing everything virtual, so bringing new students in. And I think it's taking the time. We spend time in small group discussions, in town halls, just holding some open spaces for people to be able to be who they are individually first and really working from that relationship first. In some ways, I almost think it's, oddly, it can be a bit easier because if people are a little more nervous in social situations, if they're nervous in meeting people, having a group on kind of Zoom or a virtual space or in a discussion really lets people participate as they're comfortable. It can give people time. A lot of people it takes them a bit to process information or what they might be reading or discussion. And in an asynchronous discussion board, students can read or read what their peers have posted. They can leave and then come back and have time to really think about what they're posting. And what I'm finding then is because there's a lot of variation in how people engage, but it seems to help everybody find their way of connecting almost in a less pressure environment. And then certainly when we are in person and we're able to be together, that's where we really focus on the relationship pieces and then bringing those online. And we know each other. I can hear, when I'm reading discussions, I can hear student voices in that. You know, we know each other well, but we've made that a priority. It's been a really deliberate choice.
Yeah, it's hard to cultivate, right? But the payoff is fabulous when it works well. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So maybe digging into the counseling program a little bit, what's your philosophy on the department and the type of teaching and preparation of therapists that a Saybrook counseling program should be doing and cultivating over, you know, the student's life in the program?
Yeah, it's a big question. I don't want to, I feel like I'm about to sound like a little bit of a broken record, but which is kind of an odd phrase now, but anyway, might need something new. When I think about counselor training, so whether it's the master's training clinical mental health counselors or the PhD training future educators and supervisors, as a department whole, we all start with who's the community? Ultimately, who will people be serving? And what are the needs of communities and families and children and other students? And then how do we help our students, especially in the master's program, because that's really where that identity as a clinician is starting to be formed. And it's kind of the birth of who they are as a practitioner. So we start with the community, and then what do our students need? And then it really, who are they? So even in our curriculum, like for example, a theories course or a research course, we're layering in, here's the textbook material, here's what we need for you to learn from this, and who are you in relation to these theories? Who are you in relationship to a research article you might be reading? And how will that then impact who you become as a practitioner? And how that impacts the clients that sit with you. So we work from there. We talk a lot about training for this kind of the space between a clinical session. So if I'm working as a counselor and I have a client that's across from me, so much of the therapeutic process is happening in the space that's not necessarily what a client might be saying or might not be how a family or a couple are interacting. It's what else is going on around. And so we also have made a really, specific decision, and a lot of the faculty that we've hired also just naturally tend to work kind of in that in-between space. And for me, I think that's what makes really strong clinicians and educators. Of course we teach the skills, of course we teach the theories, of course we teach the ethics, but we teach those in relation to who each individual student is and who they will be when they're working.
I want to dig into that just for a minute longer.
It's fun, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Right?
So,
well, you and I have talked about, my wife's in a counseling program now, and she's pursuing that. And the Saybrook approach, I won't name the school where she's going, because of course this is all about Saybrook, right?
Yep.
And but the interesting piece is, when they're studying ethics or they're studying kind of more of those global counseling concepts, it is very globalized, and maybe I wouldn't call it so personalized. So what does a personalized approach to ethics in counseling, for example, look like?
Right.
Yeah.
Because there certainly are things. I mean, there are ethical codes that students need to learn and understand. There are laws. But but within ethical codes, it's hard. It's challenging. It can be murky. There's some very clear ones. Don't sleep with your clients.
Yep.
There's not a lot to unpack there. It just is. But then there are things where clinicians have to make decisions about their clients or about their work. And so that's where some of the ethics, the theories, the skills can be more nuanced. Not to say we're letting students, or sort of teaching them to pick and choose, but if they're in a difficult situation, if they're facing an ethical question, or if they're having to make an ethical decision, part of what we want students to really be able to do is first kind of sit with how they're reacting. And are they reacting because of something that's close to their own experience? Are they reacting because there is something that needs to be resolved? Are they reacting from fear, from stress? Kind of what's the first sense of what they're experiencing as they're trying to make ethical decision making? And then it's, going back into the codes, consulting with other people, getting really good supervision. But it's important for people to be able to track how they're experiencing whatever the situation is, so that they can make sure they're keeping themselves out of that. If it gets too murky and too mushy, it can be harder to figure out which way to go, if something needs to be reported, if it doesn't need to be reported, what are the next steps, if there's legal issues. So that's where I think for us, there's some nuance there around who the individual is in relation to this clinical practice, when it comes to things that feel like they're really cut and dry, like ethics and legal issues, particularly when we move into classes that are looking at substance abuse, career development, human sexuality, crisis and trauma. You know, there are a lot of courses in the curriculum that hit really close to people's experiences, and we want people to learn how to boundary those, but also how to recognize when they're coming up without just trying to shove it down, because then it just comes up accidentally. And then that's where things get blurry between the client and the clinician and their decision making.
So you really see this as how they show up and how they engage in a critical thinking process throughout in their mind throughout the whole let's say consideration of ethics or legal issues as a way to kind of manage it in the moment so that they're making the best decisions as well as providing the best therapeutic support for their client, I would imagine, right?
And for our PhD students, if they're interested in teaching or advanced supervision or more advanced clinical practice, it's really a very similar process, just one a little bit of a different layer, because they're already coming in with that master's level kind of clinical practice experience. So then who are they if a student has kind of a concern or issue that rubs close to what their own experience might have been? And so then there's that kind of cognitive thinking through but not ignoring the heart that comes up, because we're all human people doing the best that we can moving through the world.
No, that's fabulous. So we're going to come back to the program in just a few minutes, but I want to kind of zoom back out.
Okay.
Talk about what we're dealing with nationally right now. Huge mental health crisis.
Yep.
You know, I think some statistics have us at 144 million unserved at present. Across the country, you know, rural, coastal, you name it, it's there. You know, the recent shooting in Buffalo to here in Southern California, highlighting and maybe accentuating the cross-sectional issues of mental health and issues around racism and managing to that, along with the trauma that's been inflicted upon so many BIPOC communities. You've got the opioid crisis, the pandemic fallout, right? I mean, I think just talking to my son, I think there's a lot of burnout across the teenagers of our country, in addition to, of course, all the adults. We're in kind of a mental health, not just crisis, I think a mess, a milieu of issues. What does this look like from your point of view as someone who's, you know, in the faculty and been working in this for so many years? And maybe kind of along with that, how do you think we start to address this both as a university and maybe more broadly?
Oh, it's huge. And it's heavy. Part of what I used to try and consider when I was working, because I was, most of my clinical work was in the midst of crisis. So kids being pulled from their homes, partners experiencing violence and needing to escape, homelessness. So that really heightened place where there's a crisis occurring. And so you're not really working through the trauma. You're kind of in this, how do you help and support, like, moment to moment? How do you keep people safe? And then later knowing that there's work to be done to address the trauma. I have been thinking about this over the last couple years similarly. You know, in the midst of the pandemic, and we're really in a collective crisis that that really went on for quite a long time. And when people are in just that high crisis mode, everything is heightened. And so you can't really get through to the processing the trauma part. And that's only one thing. You know, the pandemic was, it's almost unspeakable to think about how, like, the enormity of it in sort of the history of humans and kind of the ebb and flow of other points in pandemics and what that's looked like. And then we've sort of included what I think, what to me feels a little bit more like, an awakening. I was living in Minneapolis when George Floyd was murdered. So in the middle of that, again, a crisis, that then as we moved away in time, people could start to look at the trauma part of it. I think for me, it feels like we're starting collectively to move into trauma instead of just the crisis. And I feel like in that, and what I understand and think about in terms of crisis and trauma, is that when you start to enter into that trauma, that's where things almost get harder because you're starting to understand it. You're starting to see it differently. We're starting to see, particularly for, I'll speak for myself as a white woman, like what white supremacy has really looked like, it's almost like a little bit of an awakening to things that have been in front of us for a very, very long time. And right. So in that sort of waking up a little bit, that's where I think we're seeing more pain and more anxiety and more depression. That's one piece for one part of the population. For individuals in the BIPOC community, they've been screaming for centuries about this, and it's not new. And I think there's levels of frustration around why haven't people been paying attention? We told you, you chose not to look, you didn't have to. So collectively, I think, and each time it feels like we get closer to a healing, something else seems to be happening. So we just as a group can't collectively continue to process the trauma, particularly for young people, for adolescents, where, there's still brain development and hormones and just all of this stuff. And it can feel overwhelming, particularly as somebody that trains mental health counselors. I can see the numbers of people we're not serving, the need. I can see the numbers of potential students that aren't finding their way to training programs, people who want to help but don't know where to start. I can drown in it, and I have moments where I feel very lost. And then I sort of go back to remembering there's one piece that I can do. I can hope other people do their pieces. I can help people understand what their pieces could be. And you start to put all the pieces together, maybe there can be some change. And I think things will continue to increase, especially my hope is that we'll have an influx in students coming into these counselor training programs. And sometimes even being in these training programs can be difficult for people because it can bring up different emotions or things that aren't resolved. So that's another sort of layer for us in helping students navigate some of that.
Yeah, and the training programs are by no stretch a walk in the park, as we'll find out, right? So they can be lengthy, and the licensure piece afterwards, which we'll talk about in just a little bit, can be onerous. Definitely worth it and definitely important to go through it. But those are all pieces to it. So not to dissuade anyone thinking about it, but those are all pieces. And we don't have enough counselors out there. We don't have enough social workers. We don't have enough psychologists. I was just talking to a colleague here in Southern California. So I think this is one of the highest concentrations of therapists in this region in the country. And there are very few spots open for people to find the necessary counseling that they need. In fact, I think they said it's a negative, component. So the vacancy rate, if you will, is zero for all intents and purposes. So we've seen this outcropping of places like or entities like BetterHelp, or there's a notion of talk therapy. Some would call it the commodification of mental health and what's being done there. And yet there's not enough counselors to go around. So trying to marshal resources, what kind of thoughts do you have around this and in terms of how we address the gap in terms of therapists and patients who are seeking counseling?
I think one of the, if you can call it, gifts from the pandemic was a a force to telemental health work for mental health practitioners that had not been common or as common, particularly at the master's level with that license. But it serves a need, I mean, a huge need. So, I mean, part of it is, you know, where you are, Southern California, in some places that are more rural, you could be 2 hours out from kind of a larger city or a city with practitioners, or there might be one in the community. So one of the things I think in these newer platforms that are online or phone or texting, you know, I'm all for it. Anything that can help connect people to resources. One of the things that I hope will continue is getting better and better regulations, licensing requirements, supervision, platforms that can protect people. You know, cell phones may not be as private as somebody thinks they are. So there's some of those tech aspects that I hope will continue to develop. Even now, there's some, you know, with licensing boards and KCREP, there's a little bit of openness in some areas to do telehealth hours at the master's level, pre-license. There's some where that's being pulled back. So I hope that we can balance this out to where we can really provide good, supportive, ethical, healthy clinical practice to people who need it in whatever form people are comfortable accessing that service. Yeah. And for some people, it may just be texting, especially for people who are a little bit younger. That's kind of their main way of communicating. That's how they've built relationships. Yeah. So for them, they can build a relationship through text, or they don't need that, you know, that one-on-one. But I hope we continue to develop platforms that protect people as well.
Yeah, the privacy piece is so very important, especially in this day and age, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So people are looking for therapists, whether it's online, talk, text, whatever the platform or modality is. Maybe from your perspective, who or what makes a great therapist? And are there people who are more suited or more gifted at being a therapist? Like, what's the secret sauce to being a great therapist, Dr. Press?
I think it can be, I think there's a balance between wanting to help, wanting to support, wanting to advocate, and also being comfortable with ambiguity, being comfortable with some boundaries and, things that it could feel rigid, but they're in support of development. I think it's that mix. It's not, I think sometimes people, and we see this sometimes with students coming into the program or in their application, or that there is very typical to have our students be kind of the ones that friends always turn to, the ones that people always sought advice from. They enjoy that role. And so part of it is thinking about what is it about that role that connects for people that they enjoy so that they can help, because it is a professional relationship. And I think that's the part where really good clinicians can be very relational, incredibly humanistic, incredibly compassionate, and also realize that they're not developing a friendship relationship, that there's some boundaries there, that they're engaging in that professional manner. And that's where I think people can be really, really successful.
That's great. Those are some really great kind of mile markers or identifiers for folks who are thinking about, you know, finding a counselor as well. And kind of to that point, how do folks choose the right therapist? Like, from your perspective, what's the right process? And it's understanding it's going to be individualized. I don't know. How does someone know if it's the right fit? I can think of times when, you know, I've been in that same process of looking for someone, and it feels like I have to go through a laundry list of people before I find them, right?
It can. I think a lot of it for fit is just gut feeling. You know, if you're sitting with somebody and you're not feeling heard, or you're not sure they're really listening, or something doesn't feel right. I really encourage people to listen to that. Sometimes, and I have done this myself, I've tried a new counselor and I think, I'm not sure. And then I think, well, I'll give it another shot. And I'm still not sure. I'm like, well, I feel bad if I say it's not the right fit and I want to find somebody else. And so people, particularly when people are hurting and they need help, it can be harder. It feels risky to say to a counselor, I'm not sure this is the right fit and I'm going to go try somebody else. And it can be exhausting because each time you try somebody new, you have to sort of talk through why you're there and a little bit of history. So I think I would really encourage people, if they're starting and they haven't seen a counselor before and they're not really sure, just to trust their gut at intake or even that first session. And if it's just not feeling like the right match, paying attention to that and seeing if they can find somebody else, and sort of know that we train counselors to expect this to happen and to know that they won't be the right fit for everybody. And so you're not going to hurt a clinician's feelings by saying this isn't the right match.
Yeah.
And if that clinician says that their feelings are hurt, then it's really not the right match. And so, you know, looking for somebody else. And that's part of that struggle for counselors too, and wanting to sort of help everybody. And we just don't. I mean, it's just life. Some people you really gravitate towards and some people you just don't. And there's no kind of rhyme or reason necessarily. It's just who we are as human beings. So trusting that.
I think you've just given people a big sigh of relief, you know, or the ability to breathe a sigh of relief with that. I mean, counselors are trained to take rejection. So hopefully, you know, if you're not vibing with your therapist, it's okay to say,
yep.
You don't even have to position it as you're firing them. It's just not, you know, not the right fit, right?
So, yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so shifting gears slightly, and then we'll get into the program for a minute, but I really want to know, for students considering counseling who may not think they have the skill set, our program does a lot to support their growth in this field, as you've already mentioned. What would you say to those aspiring to become counselors who are questioning whether this field is a good fit for them?
I think, honestly, one of the things I would say is that I really value when people ask themselves that question. It's really hard work. You're working with people and it's very heart forward work. And so for people that are exploring it and wondering, I like when people sit with that for a bit and just think, why is it that I'm interested in this? What is it about that kind of role that feels like it would be satisfying to me? Because sometimes people can try to come into these sorts of programs too soon. Sometimes just their own work's not done, or with an idea of it being just different than it is. So I would start by saying, sit with that for a bit. And then I wouldn't worry too much about skills or, you know, a lot of our students are returning. They've been out of undergrad for a while. They haven't written a paper in a while. They haven't read a textbook in a while. That stuff, let go of. We help. There's a lot of support in the beginning. There's something though about that kind of natural sense of wanting to be in this work, wanting to help, wanting to advocate, wanting to help heal, and understanding why. That then when they come in, I think people are ready and they're phenomenal, and we can help them figure out how to read the textbook and not get overwhelmed. We can help write papers. We have lots of kind of mechanisms for that. We do lots of skills training. So those pieces will come, like learning any, you know, if somebody who wants to be a doctor, they don't go in knowing that already how to be a doctor. And I think because we are a relationship forward field and we're about helping, that people can feel like they should already be able to do it when they come in, and they can get frustrated. And so we have to remind people, you're learning a set of skills, you're learning a new language in a lot of ways, you're learning a professional field. And so helping people know it's okay to not know, it's okay to not be great your first semester, basic skills, nobody is, and it comes with time.
Yeah, no, those are all really good pieces of advice. And I think, you know, you've heard me say this, I know, probably ad nauseum, no one comes to graduate school as a perfect student. If we did, we wouldn't be going to graduate school. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd have the degree conferred and we'd already be in the business. So I think that's such an important point of view that you raise, and would really, you know, encourage any student who's thinking of a degree at Saybrook or anywhere really to really position it in that way, that you're coming here to, you know, really dig in and think about all the potential opportunities and options and learn as much as you can from really great faculty. So let's then kind of delve into what should a new student coming into the program expect to experience in terms of courses, faculty, time requirements, you know, et cetera. And I'm living this in real time right now. I thought I knew what it was like, you know, with our students, talking with them day in and day out. And I realized just how ignorant I was about the adult experience going back to college, typically in their 40s, people who are second and third careering, they have kids, they have a job, they're trying to balance all this stuff. My wife suggests, and of course we know this, it's not as simple as just logging in and showing up. There's so much more to doing. And of course, I think she's right. So what are your thoughts around what students should expect coming in?
One of them is to expect it to be hard, not overly hard, not burdensome, but it is. It's time consuming. So even, you know, making sure people have a schedule that lets them do schoolwork. One of the things in our sort of environment is I'm not sure people always remember, you know, because they don't have a class they have to go to on Monday night and Wednesday night, and they're kind of thinking they can work when they want to, and those things are true, but it can be easy to not leave yourself time. So pretend like you have a class on Monday night, pretend like you have a class on Wednesday night, set things up in your home, your support system, so that you can carve out, these are the times dedicated to school. If our students are on a typical full-time program, and this is true for both the master's program and the PhD, they're taking 3 academic courses in a semester. We have really worked hard to balance. Each particular semester has one class that's a little more skills-based or kind of personal development-based, with a class that might be a little more academically rigorous, and a class that might be just more kind of theory or you know, the pieces you have to learn. So we've kind of stacked them. And we've also worked hard to make sure that our curriculum across courses in a particular semester, we help students start to make some connections. So one of the classes that students might take early, if they start in a fall semester with us, they're taking a skills class and a theories class and a lifespan development class. And so across those 3 courses, in your skills course, you might be thinking about theory or bringing in kind of lifespan pieces. So we're trying to help that blend. So I would also encourage students to not think about this as like one, I got to learn this course, and then I got to learn this course, and I got to learn this course. It's more about, what am I taking from each course that's going to help my development? And then as they go through the program, they start to funnel down to really thinking about who they are in this new identity, who they are as a practitioner, who they are as an educator, what does that look like? And then they're starting to really apply more of those skills. So even though it's an academic program, it's rigorous. It's also designed to help people grow. So there's a little bit of encouraging people to kind of trust that. Across faculty. Yeah, I think those would be the big things. The time and the balance, and then just, you don't have to learn everything out of every textbook from the beginning.
Everyone should apply this concept, like carve out a day in your week or 3 days a week, right? For class. And that's what your sit-down time is. I mean, that just really makes great sense, along with all the other things you stated to help them be as successful as they can. So if I'm a student and I'm going through the program and I begin to struggle, what do I do? Who's there to support me? How do the faculty help, you know, in that process?
The one nice thing about us, and we have grown, our master's program in particular has gotten significantly bigger, and our faculty has grown. But one of the things we've been really conscious of is making sure that we still know the students. You know, we keep our courses a bit smaller still, you know, not bigger than about 12 for a clinical course, about 16 for a more academic course. So we will see if you're struggling pretty early. It's not uncommon for a faculty member to reach out. And we have a couple layers of support. So the individual course instructor, we have advisors that are within the department, which is a little bit unique and part of our KCREP accreditation requirements. And then we have program coordinators and then myself. And so there's lots of people that are there to support, even just within the department. And then, of course, Saybrook has resources outside of the department. But we know, we can see if students are struggling, if somebody misses a week or two. And we talk as a faculty each week. So if somebody, you know, if a student's not been posting in one class, we'll check and see, is the student in the other classes? And so maybe it's course specific, or maybe they're ill. So somebody will reach out and see what they need. You know, we really want people to stay tethered. And in this kind of learning platform, it can be a bit easier to sort of drift. There's lots of support. And the other thing we really try to model, being a human being who makes mistakes. I screw things up. Faculty screw things up. We're not perfect. We're not even remotely close as faculty, as a department, as students. And so we try really hard to give each other a lot of grace, particularly over these last 2 years. I mean, people are really in the day-to-day doing the best they can. And sometimes the best they can, you know, needs some support or somebody to say, hey, you know, here's what we're seeing and how can we help you grow? Sometimes if students are really struggling, we have a student review program or plan process where we'll give students really specific feedback, a couple points in time in their program, and help them grow in that way too. So sometimes it can be hard, but we go into those conversations always relationship first, wanting people to learn and to grow. We're not punitive. We're not, it can feel hard, but it's always coming from people we bring in. We can see that they can be really wonderful in this field, and we want to help them get there. And sometimes the road is a little bit bumpy, but we're there to help with that.
Well, I'd say you're all pretty perfect, but we'll go with great. So
we work hard.
Yeah, you do. You do. You work very hard, as do the students. I know that for sure.
Yep.
So what about post-degree? You know, if I'm in the program, do I get a job right away? Are there internships, practicums, you know, that are required as part of this? What does this all look like? I mean, am I going to be a student in counseling forever?
It will feel like it, maybe, but no. So the master's programs, these are big master's degrees. So there's 60 credits. The 60 credit is a requirement of our accrediting body and a requirement for almost every state is that 60 credit master's. So sometimes, you know, if students are in our program, then they know somebody that's in a 30 credit master's program, they can't figure out why they're not done yet. So it is, it's a 3-year program for the master's. Within the degree, there is a practicum and an internship in sort of the second half. So about semesters 4, 5, and 6, that is a place that requires, you know, in practicum about 1 day a week on a site, and internship somewhere between 2 and 3 to get the hours in. So again, it's another point of restructuring commitments, family, other jobs, those kinds of things for that year. And then once students are done, They can, there's a little variation state to state, but as a general rule, once you complete your degree, you apply for, it's typically an associate's license. So the state approves you to start working, to be able to be providing clinical services. You can be paid for that. So you start a job, but you're working under a supervisor. So, and that supervisor's license, so they're responsible for your work. As you're working towards your license, most states that's about 3,000 hours post-master's degree. So there's a practicum and internship pre-degree, and then there's around 3,000 hours post-degree. But people can get paid. It's a job. There's supervision, but they can start working.
So literally after your 60 hours is done and you've been conferred the degree, you can start making some money, salary to begin that. Okay, that's
Yep.
fabulous. So what about, job placement? So we've got the licensure piece you just talked about and how what all is entailed. Well, maybe we didn't talk about that enough. There is a licensure examination they have to take. And maybe just briefly talk about that, and then we'll get into job placement.
Sure. And again, there is a little bit of state variation, but every state does require an exam. For a lot of the states, and the exam is administered by the National Board of Certified Counselors, NBCC. Because we are KCRUP accredited, we have a kind of we're an affiliate of NBCC. So there's students can actually sit for those exams pre-graduation in that last semester or right after and be registered through the program. So that helps a little bit. Although there are more and more states not allowing pre-degree tests. So it's a little bit of that. But there is an exam and that's part of that licensing process that sort of happens between the student and then, well, they're the graduate, our alumni, and their state board.
Got it.
So some state boards, you can take that anytime in your 3-year window while you're getting your 3,000 hours. Some require a little bit closer. Some require pre-approval post. So it can get confusing, but we do, we start working with students to understand how to read their state licensing regulations and rules in the very first semester. During our conferences, we have time literally where our newer students are sitting on their computers looking up their state board with faculty so they can start to find these things and be tracking some of that as well.
Very good. No, that's helpful. And so if I get licensed in California, let's say, does that apply to any other state, or do I have to take that exam? If, let's say I move, do I have to retake the exam? What's the process there?
It'll depend. So typically, once you are licensed in one state, there are a lot of states that have reciprocity with other states. There are some pretty exciting things within the American Counseling Association and the licensing boards. There's a new compact that's happening. So right now there's 10 states that have signed on to be part of this, that it doesn't get you a license in the other states, but that state will then accept your license, your original license. So it starts to get complicated. The advantage of coming out of a program that's KCRUP accredited is it does make that path to moving easier. The KCRUP accreditation says to a licensing board, hey, this person has met all of the standards that are set nationally, so we know their training is going to be equivalent whether they were in California, Washington, South Carolina.
That's great. Okay. And then what about job placement and staying connected with alumni after graduation? How do you all manage that?
A lot of the job placement stuff, honestly, tends to happen within individual networks connected with their internship sites. So once students are in that field placement, they're getting to know clinicians and agencies through state organizations and affiliations. Because we're so spread out, faculty, we have some contacts in states, but that tends, it happens to happens a bit organic. We have a good percentage of our students who are hired at their sites, which has been lovely to see. And then as far as alumni connection, you know, we try to stay connected. Our graduates email us updates on how they're doing. I think that's an area we can continue to improve, again, just by virtue of being so spread out. But people come in and they talk about having among their peers, like colleagues and friends, kind of for the long run. So by the time people are out, they don't really need us much anymore. They've got their group, they've got their support, they've got each other, and so then they're just checking in with updates and the fun stuff.
And what a great testament to the counseling program that they're already landing those jobs or positions or future positions through their internships. I mean, ideally, that's what you want to see happen. I know that isn't always the case, though.
Mm-mm. So no, it's not.
So I'm going to play Toto, and you're the Wizard of Oz here. And I'm going to pull the curtain back. You're the admissions Wizard of Oz. And it can be a murky process for grad students, right, who are seeking opportunities. So can you demystify what this all looks like from the counseling program's perspective? Specifically, how should a student prepare for the process? You know, maybe you could kind of focus on, like, what are the top five things a prospective student can do to create a great application? And for those of you who don't know, counseling does group interviewing with students now, which is a new kind of approach. So what five things should that prospective student do to prepare for a great application? And maybe we can talk about the interview.
Be themselves. Also be themselves. Be clear in why you're interested in coming in. Do a little bit of research about the license, kind of make sure that clinical mental health counseling or counselor education is where you want to be, that you understand what that is, and be able to talk about that a bit in your personal statement. I try not to worry too much about an undergraduate GPA, or if you had a really difficult semester, and so your GPA is not where you'd want it to be. We get that. And so what we want to hear about and talk about is just academic readiness now. So, you know, we certainly admit students who have GPAs under that 3.0. And so we just talk about that, you know, what might be different now. And sometimes people just have a really hard transition into college or difficult, you know, things just happen. So what's more important to us is how ready people are now, that they're starting to have things with their family and work kind of set up to help them be successful, and that they understand a little bit about what they're coming into, like what this is, versus other kind of companion and related helping professions.
Okay, those are great. So you heard the five things. Want to repeat,
but being yourself and being yourself, I got those too, but yeah.
Then what about for the interview? So they're coming into this group interview setting. What are 3 to 5 things that they could do to prepare effectively for that? Maybe some of those are overlap with the application.
They really do. I mean, truly the purpose of the new interview structure, we really wanted applicants to start to get a feel for the program they were coming in. And our program really is about helping students feel connected, doing work in synchronous. You know, we have a fair amount of synchronous courses and skills-based stuff. The program's not kind of a one-on-one interview. So we wanted people to just know what that felt like and to see how quickly you can start to build connections and relationships in this sort of setting. So we do a quick kind of overview and introduction of the faculty. Then we just give a prompt really about the mission or kind of how people are coming into Saybrook or kind of why. The faculty all go off camera. So it's just the group. And it's just a conversation about how people are coming into this. And that's the group interview. So it really, it's designed to help you get a feel for what you're coming into and who we are and who other people are. Because people who find their way to Saybrook have a lot of similarities. And so it feels really good to see that already. And then there is a little break, and then there is still an individual interview with faculty that kind of all takes place in that same structure. Yeah, but it's been really neat. And, you know, we've done a couple of them so far and people are already talking about, you know, they hope they have classes together and they've found some like-minded people already. And so we're just doing it for the master's. I think as our PhD program grows, we will look at moving into something like that too. But I think once you're at the interview spot, we've already reviewed kind of the paper documents. We already can see that fit. So then it's really, I know it's kind of hokey. They say like you're interviewing us as much as we're interviewing you, but it really is true. It's just about fit. And does this feel like a place you can see yourself spending 3 years, three kind of intense emotional years? And do you want to do that with these other people that are here? And a lot of times it's yes, and that's great. And sometimes the answer is no, and then that's really okay too. And we want people to find the program that's going to be the best fit for them.
Very good. So be yourself. Mm-hmm. Know the mission of the university. Maybe yep. Read the catalog, understand the program requirements, and mm-hmm. come in assessing why you want to do it.
Yep.
What's important to you, and the added benefit is you're building community at the mm-hmm. beginning.
Yes.
This process. That is really cool. So, you know, kind of on the flip side, there is always that unfortunate experience when some students aren't selected for admission. Maybe just talk briefly about what the major reasons why, and I don't know, is this the end of the road for their counseling aspirations, or how do we give feedback? Like, how do they know where to improve?
We don't give a lot of feedback. So it's just it can feel cold, not getting accepted. But most of the time it's either we can feel like the fit's not quite there. And so recognizing that somebody just, this isn't the type of program where we think that they can be successful. And sometimes it's just a not yet, where people just aren't, you know, maybe they're not finished processing some of their own kind of histories or own trauma, or it's just a not yet. And so if you apply and we're not able to accept you, you know, taking a year or two, maybe doing some work in kind of related fields or in the community, just to get a better sense for what this work is, and a little bit more personal development, a little more space, from personal history, and then apply. Or, you know, applying in other places where you are accepted and it may just be the fit. We've certainly accepted students who didn't get into other programs and then they find themselves being really grateful that it didn't work out over there because then they fit here. And I see that as likely being true in the other direction.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, that's very helpful. So for students who do get rejected for admission, that isn't the end of the road for you, but maybe sit back and think about it. Unfortunately, those admissions letters are kind of, you know, they're kind of boilerplate. Yeah. I appreciate that. So, you know, kind of the last question around counseling in terms of the program, what's the future of the counseling programs, I should say, the mm-hmm. master's and PhD? And really, given the need nationally, do you see the program continuing to grow? Mm-hmm. What does that look like? You know, numbers, that kind of thing. How do you handle it?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Well, we've talked about this recently. I do. I see us continuing to grow. I think we could get relatively large. What feels important to me, though, is to be really purposeful and planful in that growth so that we can, like you and I can work together and other kind of upper administration at Saber can have an infrastructure that really supports students. So, you know, I could see our programs getting to maybe 300 students in the next couple of years, but not without having the structure around it, because we, regardless of our size, even, you know, in the last 7 years, we've gone from about 30 students to 130 students, but we've really tried to work hard to keep that community and that relationship first. And I feel really committed to making sure we're doing that, even if we have 300 students. And so, and that we have faculty that are like-minded and students that are like-minded, so that we don't grow and then become something that we're not. So, and I hope we can, because there is such a need, and to be able to help support communities in the future feels really important. And it's why we're all in this work.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, I love counseling and the program. I think you've all done just a fabulous job in building, you know, just a powerful curriculum and a powerful way of relating to students and to each other and to the university. It's really impressive. So congratulations on all the successes thus far. So I have, you know, the rapid fire.
Oh, no. All right.
So I'm going to bring it on here. The two main questions. You know, my questions are always multi-questions.
Right.
So what does the term humanistic mean to you? Specifically, how does it show up in counseling?
To me, it means honoring the person that's in the room with me, or group of people that are in the room with me, no matter how they're coming in and what they're experiencing and what their past has been, what their present is. It's just letting us be two human beings, or eight human beings if I'm running a group, and letting the rest of that go and letting us all be together in that moment towards healing.
That was pretty impressive there, Dr. Preston.
Thank you.
I like that. All right. And
it's easy because it's who we are as a department. Yeah. So didn't feel like a trick one.
It's such a natural fit for Saybrook, which is a humanistic focused institution. Yeah. All right. So before we leave, since you're in the mental health space, what are three things folks can do right now from your perspective to improve or advance their mental health in a positive way?
Take a couple deep breaths. Even if you don't feel like you can, okay. Go outside, even if it's just for 1 or 2 minutes, walk outside, find someone or something to connect to. Online can be a book, a pet, an animal, community, just something, so that each day you're doing a little more breathing, you're getting a little bit of air, and you're feeling slightly less alone in all of the garbage.
Great wise words from Dr. Preston. Breathe.
And eat a little broccoli. Walk. Little veggies.
Well, that was four.
That's a bonus.
That too.
Yeah.
I don't know that some people would see broccoli as a bonus, but
yep.
Well, Jennifer, thank you for such a wonderful interview. And thank you for all that you and your faculty are doing and for all your wonderful students. So really appreciate you being here.
You're
today.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
Wow. Jennifer was fabulous. Thank you, Dr. Preston, for joining us today on Saybrook Insights. That was really a terrific interview. She and I were joking just right after the recording. We should take the show on the road. It's like we've done this forever. I think we need to start our own talk show. She really provided some great elaboration on the counseling program, of course, but also insights around mental health. And, you know, in my introduction, I think you heard the intensity around the need. And I want to leave you with that again, that now more than ever, we need people, caring people, people dedicated to really helping us solve this puzzle of mental health in our country. And there is so much demand and not enough supply of therapists out there, qualified good therapists. So I hope Jennifer inspired you today with our conversation. If you want to see video elements of this podcast today, we've created these segments. You'll find these on YouTube, across our social media platforms, and on the Saybrook website at saybrook.edu. Go to Areas of Study at the top of the website, click on Counseling, and you can find those there with links to various segments in addition to this podcast. And if you'd like to support the podcast, go to Apple iTunes and leave a 5-star rating and a review. And please make sure to subscribe so you can get episodes as they come out. If you're on Spotify, leave that 5-star rating and make sure to follow us. And you can, of course, subscribe to us on most major podcast platforms, including Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Pandora, and others. For more about our counseling program, go to www.saybrook.edu. Click on that areas of study at the top of the page and locate the program to learn more. Or you can simply Google Saybrook University Counseling Program, and that's going to pop right up for you, and you can click on that link and go to the program page. Thank you once again for joining me on Saybrook Insights. It is a pleasure to have you along for the ride, and we look forward to many more episodes in the future for you and for our community. With that, be well, take good care, and go out there and make positive social change.